I don't know if it was what you were saying, ANC coming back to 50%. That's very different to what most people are saying, Francis.
Well, until 2 years ago, everyone in the polling world had them at 47, 8, 9, 50, 51, 52. The only reason they're not there is that Mr. Zuma has taken a chunk off them and a big chunk out of the EFF. Now, he's very capable, Zuma. He's a serious, if I had to go to war on this stuff and want a strategist in my camp, I'd seriously consider him or, you know, he's very popular in South Africa. I've spoken sort of in high places in South Africa, and people sort of exclaim, it's impossible. How could anyone vote for that man? But he's cast himself very well. It's not his policies or his manifesto that win the support. His supporters probably totally unaware of both. He's cast himself as the fallen cadre, the hero, who is flawed, but everyone is, they tend to identify with that. And he's now been maligned and persecuted and neglected by a distant and aloof ANC that's more comfortable here or in the glistening towers of Sandton, because they glisten again, not the lights, but the glistening towers of Sandton. And that resonates with a substantial number of voters. And as long as he can hold that, he can, you know, approach 10% of the vote in this election.
So if he takes 10% and the EFF's at 10%, how's the ANC going to get close to 50?
Well, if he takes 10 and the EFF takes 10, let's say he's eating the EFF, so the EFF's going to do about an 8. The ANC sits in that 45 to 50 band. What it wishes to do, let's take a step back, because I've noticed since I've been here, and in America too, this isn't understood. The EFF and the ANC might look the same to you sometimes. You read their manifestos, there's an echo of, there's a common origin. But they represent two fundamentally different strains of the liberation movement. In the 80s, the ANC in practice expels from its ranks what it calls the ultra-left of the party. And this is the left of the ANC. It's all left, but there are divisions here. And the reason they do so is the ANC objective is to regulate the means of production to the advantage of the state, not to seize it. Whereas the ultra-leftists wish to seize it, even if it's destroyed, they see that as a revolutionary achievement. And out of the inferno, they could build a utopia, like a North Korea or Venezuela or something of the like. And the ANC is very alarmed by this and says, look, if we try to run a mine or sink a mine shaft or start a bank or anything, it will be a catastrophe. The country will collapse and we'll lose power. And what that means is the ANC is quite conservative. When it runs into trouble, which it often does, runs out of electricity or threatens vast deficit, it will, as a rule, stop. And facing serious resistance, this is Lenin, that when you probe with a bayonet, if you hit steel, you stop and you withdraw. If you hit mush, you continue. And when the ANC runs into trouble, it will stop and withdraw. So it runs out of electricity and it flees the private sector and says, please do something. And the railways collapse and the ports stop functioning and they do the same and they threaten the deficit. They put pressure downwards on expenditure. If you go and read the statistical annexures of the budget, not the colorful infographics the finance department provides to entertain weak journalists, you'll see that on core areas, there are real cuts in government expenditure. The EFF is a different strain. It will proceed regardless of the resistance. Inside the ranks of the ANC, this is well understood, and it's there are, of course, sympathizers to the EFF. There's a caucus inside the ANC. But there are many others who say that if we capitulate to these people or strike a deal with them, it will mark a profound shift, the most profound shift in the philosophy behind our ideology in 40 years, and it will be destructive. So there's resistance for that reason to the ANC-EFF deal. While we're on the subject, You also, if you make a deal with the EFF, you have to share patronage. I mean, there'll be a negotiation. Who's going to get the money? And your ANC side might lose out, causes terrible internal division. So that 45 and above zone, if the EFF's at 8 and MK's at 10, the ANC preference is going to be, should be, but for one thing I'll say now, then I'll stop, is to strike a deal with the rats and mice and carry on. The only, where am I wrong? It's compromise. The extent to which corrupting information is available to force an alternative deal in which the EFF caucus within the ANC manages to displace its current leadership. And if you see the flag go up of the philosophy behind the ideology is similar, but the philosophy behind the ideology change, that would be the most dangerous moment South Africa could reach now, but I think it's unlikely that it's going to happen. But
there is a school of thought that feels the ANC, anything below 50% would be perceived internally as a failure, hence withdraw or recall yet another president, and then the new president, who is much more has much more affection with the EFF, would lead us into that kind of a scenario. How high would you put that likelihood?
Well, the joke there now is 45 is the new 70 in the ANC. If we can get to 45, it's a masterpiece of electioneering, you know, and relativism again. It's perfectly, on the balance of probabilities, they're going to be 45-ish up a bit. They're going to strike a deal with the rats and mice. But there's a serious prospect, enough that it should concern anyone, that the compromise overwhelms even that and that this deal is made. And then sentiment shifts on the country and we go through a very negative era. However, I think it's perfectly survivable. It will be very, very hard. I've said to you there's a natural immunity in the political system to bad governance. It's not true the ANC can govern with impunity. It governs well, it's rewarded. It governs badly, it's losing an election. That's why we're here. It's simple as that. And if you put the ANC and the EFF together, the shock to sentiment in and of itself means there's absolutely no prospect for a growth recovery or a jobs recovery. And the downward trajectory of their collective support will accelerate and the EFF will be exposed. It's never been in government, really. And when people see what the consequences are, mainstream opinion is centre-right, they'll be decimated. And then the clock will start ticking. Because to survive, the ANC and the EFF will have to ensure that we do not get to another free election. That's the only serious prospect. They'll have to print. There'll be a flag. They're printing money, because they want to create inflation, to create populism. Otherwise, they lose an election. And again, if you do a balance of probabilities, it will be more difficult for them to achieve that than it will be for South Africans and institutions to defeat them at that. It's not guaranteed, but you probably win. And around the fringes of some of the political thinking in South Africa are some sharp people who absolutely concede the vast risk in this, but who say, push the ANC and the EFF together, do that, call their bluff, tell them to do their worst, go for it and govern the country. Because in 2029, there will be a clear choice for voters, where at the moment the choice is a bit opaque. There'll be a clear split. Now, inside the ANC ranks, Gabriel and I have seen that a third of the current voter base wishes to leave them. They wish to leave the ANC. That's 15% of this election. They will go, they may very well go after the ANC EFF. We've also tested the consequences of Ramaphosa's departure, which is a difficult thing to do, but it's perfectly plausible. And on that afternoon where he had a wobble and thought he would leave, this was actually sent along, that they lose 5 to 10 percentage points on his departure because of his importance to holding them up. So you put ANC EFF together, the immune system of the political, of the immunity inbuilt in the political system accelerates their demise. Ramaphosa knocks them another 4 or 5 points, you could beat them in 2029. So I'm no matter how you play this ANC EFF deal making, there's still quite strong upsides for the country. And the ANC people who in private concede this, and what terrifies them almost more than anything else is the idea that they make the lazy, stupid populist decision now, go for the populist and double down on the rural base. And the consequence of that decision for the ANC is it's going to become a rural, regional party centered in Limpopo, Northwestern, and Mpumalanga, where they will have their final conferences in a marquee on the Botswana border as dust sort of swirls around them, and they talk about when we governed in Southern Africa. So they also have a vast strategic challenge now to make decisions based on this result that keep them relevant to the aspirant urban fringe middle class, aspirant middle class. Otherwise, a rural future of insignificance may well be where they're headed.
You've given us some wonderful scenarios, but the thing that continues to encourage me in conversation with you is that you were like the super bear for a long time. Certainly at the IRR, you were calling out the ANC at a time that nobody else was, so not to the degree that you were. And yet, in our recent conversations over the last 18 months, you've been pretty upbeat. Now, I'm sure there are people in the audience, this being London, thinking the weather's better, the rugby players are better, taxes are lower, the cost of living is a lot lower. But man, are we going to become Zimbabwe again? What would you, if that was your son sitting in the audience asking that question about maybe taking his skills back home and making a contribution to his country, what would your response be?
Look, I mean, the methods applied to the problem today are the same as what we used then, that we don't really read the press or worry about what it says. You go to original sources, you understand history, you get a good sense of what the politicians, what truly motivates them. You understand deeply, and you have a lot of data, and then you get the calls right. All we were doing in that first era is we're getting the calls right. That was very unpopular. And the methodologies are the same. Maybe we're wrong this time, but maybe sit here and you'll one day say they were wrong. That's possible, but the approach to the problem is the same. South Africa is, I mean, people should live where they want to and where they're most comfortable. South Africa is becoming a normal, highly volatile emerging market. That's what it is. It does not have a short-term recovery scenario where it leaps back to very high levels of economic growth and prosperity and stability. It has a strong enclave flavor to it, which will deepen and deepen if the country, and it could hold the middle classes perhaps forever inside the enclaves. So I suppose that the question is, do you want to sort of, it's a bit of a frontier in a sense. I mean, it's not, I kind of work off the patio of a country club in Johannesburg, so it's not really frontier existence. But I think the outlook for absolute collapse and catastrophe is, if that's what fears people, is you must take it seriously. But I think on the balance of probabilities, that's not where it's at this time.
We've had a number of questions, so I'm gonna kick off there with one from Simon. He wants to know about the view of Rise Mzansi's prospects. And I guess in that context, you could just apply your mind to some of the other smaller parties as well, the Patriotic Alliance, Action SA, and so on, who are getting a lot of news coverage. How are they likely to do in this election?
Look, I mean, you can measure it. We publish it every morning. Rise Mzansi has limited prospects, sitting at under 1%. Now, that's on a margin of error of 2, so you don't know. It's a party that...
that mean? A margin, well,
the margin of error is, let's say we say a party's got 10%. It means it could have 12 and could have 8. That's about as good as you're going to get in this stuff.
So, so if you're
a party
3.
That's got 1%, you're smaller than even the margin of error. So they're very small, and they must be, because their message cannot work in any South African political constituency other than the glistening towers of Sandton. They don't feature. It's not a thing that could possibly ever work. You said to me, Gayton McKenzie, leader of the PA, serious guy. Take him very seriously. He might not have had the early life experience of many of us in this room, but he reads serious economics now and books. In my experience, he's perhaps the most voracious consumer of our data that we produce. He is... I sometimes, if I meet a new politician, I say, what's the purpose of politics? And very often in the sort of Western world, a youngster will tell you, well, you know, we want to help and be good. And McKenzie straight up said the accumulation and application of power, which is the right answer. He's had a little lift in the Western Cape over recent days. He managed to almost fill a stadium. Western Cape demographics split 20, 30, 50, white, black, coloured. And holding that province for either the ANC or the DA will become difficult if coloured nationalist leadership takes hold. And your assumption must be at some point it may do that. So he's a serious guy. Then we're in the
Herman, Herman Mashaba?
I, polling low down, 2-3. I don't think, had it been possible to position him as a serious kind of candidate, he might have done very well.
Leave it there. And Musi Maimane?
Look, ex-ANC, ex-DA, resonates with the centre-right. I maintain that he's a very interesting prospect. He raised very little money for his party, unfortunately, I think, relative to what some others raised. I estimate that on donors to new parties, it takes 20 to 30 million rand to get 1% of the vote in this election. And the party funding legislation, therefore, has made it impossible for smaller parties or established parties to succeed. But if you're budget is delivered in a box to an Air Force base, then, of course, that there isn't an IEC official there who inspects the cash in the box and writes it up as part of your declaration. So funding-wise, these smaller parties that act as a very damaging piece of legislation, because it's meant, and I suspect, not this wasn't happenstance. It was perfectly clear that the ANC was going to get to a point that it's under 50. And was perfectly clear at that point that the former backers of the sort of CR camp would start looking at alternatives. And it was perfectly well understood that it takes enormous amounts of money to run successful election campaigns. And so a piece of legislation was introduced that meant that future challenges to the ANC could not succeed. They were stillborn.
Can we have your view, this is from Graham, on the signing of the NHI bill into law?
Look, I said to you on the ANC that it reads it will read every morning what it calls the balance of forces of the revolution. if it believes the balance of forces are enabling of the revolution, there's no resistance. They will advance. If they poke that bayonet into the medical industry and it hits steel, they will step back. This is the rule. It is an unbroken rule of ANC strategy, a very sensible rule for them too. If you see them advancing on a counterproductive idea like this, it is because groups that have the influence to stop them have been reluctant to bring hard power forward and have often encouraged or enabled them. A chap who did a lot of mining policy work on South Africa at the time that the industry was sliding so quickly said the mistake of his clients was the idea that we will go along to get along with government, and then you enable this stuff. And that's what the healthcare industry is doing. If it takes not an aggressive stance or hostile, but makes it clear that there is a firm line that cannot be crossed, and indicates that in a sophisticated way to the government, which includes publicly, on NHI, the government will stop and reverse. And you will even find that there are within the ranks of the ANC individuals who will be grateful that someone stopped them. Because it's not run like a business with a CEO who, answerable to a board, takes executive decisions. It's a collective. And you can't go to a meeting of the executive committee of the ANC, which is 80 ordinary members, and a couple of other hangers-on, 100 people with such a diverse range of interests, the most common of which is to stay out of prison, and say that I think, as an individual, that we're all wrong. So it helps what pragmatists there are. Remember, they're not printing money. It's a complex organization. It's done very badly, but it also hasn't turned to printing aggressively. It hasn't jailed the opposition. If there's firm external resistance, the pragmatists in the NEC can do this sort of thing. They can say, you know, those terrible people in the medical industry, awful. They've said that if we carry on like this, there will be no more investment. London will turn on us. The Rand will collapse. They are terrible, but you know, we should perhaps just slow down on this. And the understanding of how to do that within corporate South Africa and amongst Western diplomats has never been very strong, I think.
Sad. Do you think, this is from Josh, do you think big business feels betrayed by Cyril and his NHI approach? You've kind of answered that, haven't you?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I think there's even sympathy for it within business. I think there are even corners of it which would perhaps at a certain ideological level go along with the ideas behind it. So no, I don't think it feels betrayed.
But there's 1.5 trillion rands in South African balance sheets, which is waiting to be invested. And the follow-up to that question from Josh was, how might this impact their be encouraged to deploy those cash balances after the 29th of May?
Well, it's part of the compounding evidence, which says stand on South Africa and watch what happens. It just adds to the overall tenor of the place. But to free up that, you know, Kevin Lings at Stanlib makes the point that corporate cash and deposit with South African banks has increased at twice the inflation rate for 10 or 15 years. So even within the country, there sits this money. And that's what he says. And then he doesn't say the next bit. I say the next bit. That to free that up, you need certainty, but not certainty that it's headed downhill. The ANC sometimes misunderstands that part. You need certainty that property rights are completely secure. NHI is an attack on property rights, an attempt to tax essentially savings and reroute them and pivot the cadre deployment model that the ANC's internal unity depends on from from access to public funds, which are under greater scrutiny and are diminishing, to the deep pools of private capital. NHI's not for the entire organisation, for much of it's just a bone to chew on, but for a sinister fraction, a way to set a precedent on perhaps a later national social security fund, which is being considered, which would free up vast amounts of money to continue cadre deployment for decades and decades to come. But anything of this nature, hostile mining policy, foreign policy, whatever it is in the ANC, if you understand how that party views the balance of forces, and this isn't a thing it does lightly or occasionally, this is core to strategy. And if you can play that game with the South African government, you can make a vast amount of progress. You can do that on labor, you can do that on empowerment, you can do it on property rights, and only if that happens. But it must be an external inflection point, because the nature of that executive meeting of the ANC is you can't raise a good idea, because you'll be cut. Tall poppies don't survive. With that external inflection en masse, South Africa could stage a, but there's no clear evidence of where that would come from now, but South Africa would probably stage a remarkable economic recovery.
Wendy says, I've heard France talk about the location of power in South Africa and that business can make a bigger difference and impact. I've heard Wayne Duvenage, who in fact will be here today a little later, say the same. How do we harness this power for change?
Well, you need to get the analysis right. The reason I think people are, if they are disappointed or betrayed at the ANC, it's in part because they've never properly understood it. They've never had the analysis right of what it is and how it operates, and therefore how you respond to it. Not as a hostile party or trying to bring the thing down. And I've over the last year or two, you know, a lot of people come to see you and say, you know, how do we bring the ANC down? We must now destroy it. It's a useless organization. The country won't survive 1 week after the date of the election if the ANC is still there. And I've said to you, I don't think that's true. It will suffer damage, but it will survive. But if you say to people, well, what would you replace it? They can't answer you. And that, I think, is very dangerous. I put it to you, you can argue with it. You might. It's safer to leave the ANC, given what I've described it to you as in power, than to roll the dice on defeating it by a landslide and not knowing what you're going to put in place after it. And if you want this transition to happen towards this future of the center, the centrist multi-generational urban party and the other one, give it, it's a 10-year process. And there's a way to do that. We might get into that today. And I'm happy for this point to be shot down. So I know it's provocative. But it's very dangerous to change the leadership of a country if you have no idea what will come in its wake in the 2 weeks after that defeat.
Well, I guess there are lots of people who think that they will be able to do a good job. But Ian wants to put you on the spot. He says, if one wanted to vote to preserve liberal democratic objectives and for the best future for South Africa, where should you be putting your cross?
Well, I mean, I don't mind answering that. Go look for parties that reflect broadly liberal Western democratic values. And so, I mean, James is here. The DA is a perfectly good example of such a party. It's not very difficult to do. The only reason you might not do that, the only reason you might not do that is you might, which is very unlikely that anyone would go along with this at all, is you might be worried about what happens to ANC if it does collapse and what happens to the country in the immediate aftermath. But, I mean, the choices are clear. And I still think, well, I'll say for today, maybe others will be able to demolish this by the end of the day. If you want the unitary state to survive and be stable, the Rubicon to cross is that between the established middle class commanded by the DA, which is a great constituency to have, and it shouldn't be pressured to go pick up another one because it's very hard to do. It could be quite dangerous. And the aspirant middle class that the ANC might still command if it doesn't take stupid decisions in the aftermath of this election result. And therefore, whether you sort of on the one side or the other broadly, the way I might think about it is this is 10 or 15 years from today, if we have this political balance in place, then South Africa might be very successful.
10 or 15 years from today. We've got lots of conferences, I guess, to look forward to.
That's important. This rushing around is very dangerous. These people who 6 months before the election will sit in across the table from you and say, we want to start a political party to defeat the ANC so that, because it won't survive one day off. This stuff is a long, hard grind. And a chap like James will address you later will just tell you that. There are no shortcuts. There are no easy victories. If you want to change the society for the better, you invest in the process of change, which is not just political parties, but the climate of opinion in which change that's needed for change to occur. And it will take you 10 or 20 years to see real progress. The short-termism, this idea that the next quarter matters, it's taught in business schools, is the reason why Western analyst institutions and diplomats are losing global battles of ideas, because their Chinese and Russian adversaries would find it extremely ambitious to think that the change process could be executed in 10 to 20 years. It might be 50 or 100.
I'm reminded of that. We've got for South African standards, a very old tree, a 200-year-old tree in our garden, the most magnificent coral tree. And I'm kind of reminded of that often because in the news business, there's a news cycle that happens too often. But maybe the last question before, I'd love, you haven't even hardly mentioned the DA, and James is here to talk about oil and gas, not about the political parties. I'd love to get some thought there, but Dirk's come a long way to attend this conference. So his question is, calling the bluff and having an EFF-ANC coalition, we'll see more and more people die from tertiary unintended consequences, like people dying in burning buildings in Hillbrow, construction building collapse in George, people dying in psychiatric institutions and in hospitals, not to mention the very high rate of death on the roads and due to traffic accidents, farm murders, rampant violent crime, etc. Can we afford such an experiment?
Dirk's absolutely right. That will be one of the consequences. It will be one of the consequences, undoubtedly. Here are some other consequences. You stampede the opposition and the ANC into a deal with each other under pressure. The opposition doesn't have the influence to change macro-level policy to enable higher growth because there's a resistance in the climate of opinion. It's not necessary to do that. It becomes jointly culpable with the ANC for failure. You get to the next election, South Africans say, you know, these politicians are all useless. Look at the DA. It's been in government for 5 years. There are no more jobs than there were before. And people then lose their confidence in democracy, which they still have, amazingly. And if you do that and you damage the institution of opposition politics by moving quickly and hastily without forethought, and the confidence in democracy is lost, you've opened the door to populism. And that is disastrous for us. There are no very positive short-term results here, but on balance, the cards we have, we are very fortunate to have. We have a party that is not an efficient party of cruel fascist autocrats. When you get that, you're away already. And I could brief you on the civil war in Sudan. That's a problem. Second thing we've got is public opinion is not radicalized. hugely moderate. I do work in some other parts of the world. I mean, it just makes South Africa the easiest bet ever. The third thing we have is the money is not being printed, which it really should be. I mean, what we should be seeing in South Africa now is a populist party that's surging to 60% of the vote, the ANC running the presses 24/7. James, I'm made, but such a prominent guy, examples of, in prison in a dungeon under the Union Building. So you'd all ask, how's he doing? Has anyone seen him for, you know, since he was last seen? We don't have any of that stuff. That's, if any, when that stuff manifests in South Africa, it'll be very hard for someone in my position to sit in front of you and say there are strong upsides for the country. If we move too rapidly and too hastily without proper forethought, we may bring about these consequences without an understanding of their implications. It's a tough country. We know each other, but you know that. The 400 years that got us here were of conquest and mad economics and persecution and enslavement and frontier wars and the Boer War and the rebellion in 1914 and 1948 and Sharpeville and Soweto and everything after that. And the consequence of all of that absolute chaos and turmoil is this hugely impressive society that South Africa is today in the relative order of things. So you're right, that will happen. But I think the serious people need to think in 10, 20 year terms on South Africa. And they need to invest deeply in the process now of bringing together these two political constituencies, whichever parties end up leading them. And if that can be achieved, which it easily can, then the long-term outlook for the country is extremely strong, very strong.
Hello. Frans Grenier, thank you.